Before you start listening to this podcast, we've got a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, which will give you full access to everything on our website, and we'll also throw in a free £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator Books Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of the Spectator, and this week my guest is Hadley Freeman, whose new book is called House of Glass, The Story and Secrets of a 20th Century Jewish Family. Hadley, this book begins as, well, many of its type do, with a dusty shoebox in a closet.
It does indeed.
Tell me about the shoebox. What did you find in it?
I literalized the trope there. So I was going through my grandmother's closet about 10 years after she died. My uncle moved into her old apartment, so he'd kept all of her stuff. And I thought about writing about her relationship with fashion. I was at that point a fashion writer on, sorry to tell this to Spectator listeners, the Guardian newspaper. And I thought I could write about her relationship with clothes and how she used clothes as part of her identity. And I just saw the shoebox at the back of the closet and thought it would just have another pair of, you know, old shoes in it, as you would, and opened it, and it was full of letters and albums and photos from the 1920s up to the 1980s, photographs that were clearly taken in a concentration camp, prison plates, a drawing by Picasso kind of shoved in as an afterthought at the bottom, denunciation letters written during the war in French. And at that point I thought, oh, bloody hell, it's gonna be more than a fashion piece, isn't it?
Yeah. Let's start with your grandmother. I mean, it ends up being a book that's about really quite a big family. Mm. And, you know, it goes from the sort of Polish shtetl to the Parisian salons to Long Island. It's all, you know, it's a kind of history of 20th century Jewry and capsule. But Sala is your point of entry. She's this, you know, dandy French lady living in Long Island.
Right, right. So I met my grandmother when she was in her 70s. She was this very beautiful, melancholic Jewish grandmother in Miami Beach, where she then lived with my grandfather. And to me, she was always incredibly French. You know, she would always talk like, oui, 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 oh la la, da, da, da. I mean, she was my image of Frenchness. When I saw the film Gigi with Leslie Caron, the MGM musical, to me, she was Hermione Gingold in it. That's what my grandmother was like, but very chic. And whereas all other grandmothers I knew, you know, would bake cakes and, you know, kind of wear frumpy clothes, my grandmother hardly ate. She would wear a sort of Chanel-style jacket. She collected little Dior handbags. She was not very grandmotherly, but she was very French. But she was also quite sad. There was something about her that was very detached. This was obviously not the life she wanted. And I found that very difficult to handle as a child. I didn't understand how grown-ups could be sad. I thought grown-ups were just there to, you know, buy me ice cream, really.
Yeah, and there's this kind of piercing moment. It's one of the earliest memories you describe is a trip to Paris with, like, the whole family. I think it's your first trip to Paris, isn't it?
It's my first trip to Europe. So I was born and grew up in New York, and my father wanted me to know the French side of my family. So my grandmother, Sala, was his mother. So we all flew to Deauville, which is this little seaside town in Normandy. My grandmother came with us from Miami, and her two older brothers were meeting us there. And we arranged to meet everybody in the hotel restaurant. And we were waiting, and we were waiting for my grandmother. I was meeting these two old men called Alex and Henri, and Henri's wife, Sonia. And we're waiting for my grandmother, and suddenly I notice Sala standing outside the room, and I look at her, and I realize she's watching us crying, and then she turns around and runs away.
And, well, let's start, go back maybe to the beginning, you know, how she ended up where she was and how she was. I mean, it's a story really of four siblings, isn't it?
Exactly. And I mean, I knew nothing before I started. I really didn't. I didn't know that there had been a third brother, Jacques, who I'd never met. And I certainly didn't know that my grandmother was actually Polish. I mean, like I said, I thought she was just purely French. But it turned out they were all born in this tiny town in what is now Poland, but what was then Austro-Hungarian Empire, called Sarnow, which is just 18 kilometers from Auschwitz. And they were called back then Yehuda, Jacob, Sender, and Sala. Once they fled to Paris, they changed their names to French names. But they grew up in this tiny little shtetl. It was like something out of an Isaac Bashevis Singer story, Fiddler on the Roof. And they led this very poor, peaceful life. And then World War I started and everything immediately went terrible. Their father went off to war. His lungs were irrevocably gassed. He never recovered. He died after he got home. And then the pogrom started. Poland was liberated. Poland had obviously had suffered enormously during the war. It was economically, you know, destroyed. It, you know, people had marched back and forth across it. And as happens, people were looking for someone to blame, and in this case they blame the Jews. And so pogroms started across the country where Catholics were rampaging through Jewish towns and destroying Jewish businesses, killing the Jews, and the first town that had a pogrom was Sarnow.
You describe, or somebody, I mean, you have a first-hand account of them. it's like their neighbours. It's the people they really knew.
It was absolutely the people they knew. So one of the other pieces of luck that I encountered during the research of this book was I found my great uncle Alex's unpublished memoir, which was also hidden in my grandmother's apartment. And he describes this pogrom that they all endured, the first one.
He was then what, 10-ish?
He was 12 years old. Yeah. And it was the three boys and Salah hiding under the bed with their mother. And Alex was 12 years old and he could hear all this noise outside. And he thought, I'm not going to hide like a coward. And he got up from under the bed and ran outside to try to fight against the poles. And he saw their faces. He describes them as looking twisted like beasts in the moonlight. And he looks closer and he realized they're his teachers and they're his neighbors. And they're the men who bought sewing machines from his father in the marketplace. And he knew them. And he writes in his memoir, it was at that moment my childhood ended. I never trusted anyone again.
And so when they got a bit older, they fled, pretty much.
They fled. So they all eventually left Poland. They all went to Paris, where their cousins, the Ornsteins, were already living. And the irony is that the pogrom actually saved their lives. If they hadn't left, they'd have definitely been killed in World War II. The whole of Sarnow's Jewish population, which was 55% of the town, were killed in World War II, obviously, because it was so close to Auschwitz. And if you go to Sarnow now, there's still no Jews. And when I went with my father in 2018, we found the house where my grandmother and her brothers lived, and right next door to it, the building was covered in anti-Semitic graffiti. So it's still this problem, even though it's 18 kilometers down the road from Auschwitz, people are still very anti-Semitic. So they all fled to Paris in the 1920s, which is where huge numbers of Eastern European Jewish immigrants were going. They were going either to Warsaw, to Paris, or to New York. And the reason so many went to Paris is because it was further away from Eastern Europe than Warsaw, not as far away as New York, and it already had a good-sized Jewish population. It also didn't have any quotas yet on the numbers of Jews allowed in, unlike the UK and the US. Also, France had as well suffered enormously in World War I, and it desperately needed a male workforce. So it was encouraging a lot of these immigrants to come, particularly after the Dreyfus Affair. France had really had this reckoning about anti-Semitism in the country. It was really abated. They wanted these Jews to come to the country. They wanted them to help in the industry. They reduced the number of years foreign Jews had to be in the country to be naturalized, so it was easier for Jews to start working. So the Glass family all went, and Jacques started working as a tailor in the Marais, like a lot of Jewish immigrants. Henri eventually joined him, and they set up business together. Alex, in characteristic pugnacious style, refused just to be a tailor. He wanted to be a couturier, like Lanvin, and he set up a couture salon at the age of only 20. And my grandmother, Sala, was in and out of sanatoriums because she suffered from pleurisy. And eventually, when she got home in her 20s, she started working as a textile designer.
Yeah. Now, these four siblings, I mean, it almost feels as if they're a sort of, like, paradigmatic kind of split for different Jewish reactions to anti-Semitism. In Sarah, you've got flight, you've got compliance in Jacques, which has a sort of tragic outcome. You know, Alex is a sort of defiance, really, but you know, negotiation. And then, you know, Henri hides.
Exactly. I mean, if I was writing this as a novel, I feel like no one would believe it. But their four reactions were the four reactions that were available to Jews. So first of all, Henri, when he was in Paris, he tried to assimilate very well. He wanted to be French. Then when the war started, he hid. He got a false ID. He had invented this amazing machine. He was a brilliant engineer that allowed him to shrink documents to save them from Nazis and the Vichy government. And he traveled around France in secret all through the war, shrinking towns' documents, people's bank records, building plans for ports, the Havre port, for example, so that after the war was finished, he was able to help these towns rebuild and help people get their money back. But he was hiding. Jacques believed that if he followed the rules, nothing bad would happen to him. So as soon as the Jews were told in 1940 they had to register, he, unlike anyone else in his family, went off and registered. He was then rounded up in one of the first roundups, sent off to a French concentration camp, Pithiviers. Alex was completely defiant. He went off to the Foreign Legion, fought in the Narva campaign, got a Bronze Star, then went down to the south of France, was living this glamorous life with Christian Dior, who he worked with, and this other man, Jean Sator, who's possibly his lover. When the Nazis came to the south of France, Alex was in a nightclub one evening, and the nightclub started playing German music. And
this was like the worst row over the jukebox ever.
Yes, quite. And also straight out of Casablanca, which makes it even weirder. And Alex stood up and said, "Stop playing this Nazi shit. You need to play the Marseillaise." And the Nazis came up to him and said, "We know where you live, Alex. We're coming to get you." And the next day they came.
Well, one of them pulled a gun on him, didn't
pulled
they?
A gun gun in the nightclub. And Alex laughed at him and said, look at this man waving a gun around women. And Alex left the nightclub. His mother was living with him. He incredibly managed to stash his mother, who not only couldn't speak French, but insisted on only keeping kosher, stashed his mother with one of his clients. And incredibly, she survived the war. And
it's sort of astounding. They say, you know, Polish, Yiddish-speaking, little old Jewish lady who keeps kosher somehow survived the whole of the war in occupied France.
In France. You know? And there are no records of her. No one knew she was there. I mean, she was just hidden in this room the whole time keeping kosher. Alex, meanwhile, was arrested the next day and put on the train to another French concentration camp called Drancy. And Sala, well, she had the option that was basically the only thing available to women then. She couldn't fight in the war. There were women in the resistance, but not as many as men, of course. So instead, she got married. She was tricked into marriage by Alex, who just wanted to get her out of the country.
Well, there was this kind of absolutely heartbreaking story in her, because she, you know, it complicates this idea that, you know, we were the lucky ones, we got out.
Absolutely. And particularly for Jewish Americans, we are all raised thinking anyone who comes to America, it's the promised country. Immigrants are so happy. They kiss Ellis Island when they get off the boat. That was very much not the case with my grandmother. She was 26. She was living the life of her dreams in Paris. She was engaged to a socialist dentist, planning her wedding. One night, Alex comes around for dinner and says, my darling sister, my wonderful friend from America, very dear friend, has come to visit. I've brought him around for dinner. He's a millionaire. He lives on Park Avenue. He runs a fashion company. You must meet him. In comes this American guy with a mustache. They all speak Yiddish to each other because he doesn't speak French. They don't speak English. And in the middle of dinner, he says, you are the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life. Please come to America with me and marry me. My grandmother just thought, who is this ugly John Wayne guy? Who's this tacky guy? Of course not. I'm marrying my lovely socialist dentist. Dinner ends. Alex turns to her and says, you are marrying him. You have to marry him. The Nazis are coming. I know they're coming. What's happened in Poland is going to happen here. This guy is incredible. You will never get a better offer. Eventually, with enormous reluctance, my grandmother goes to America. This American meets her at the dock. And on the drive from the dock to his house, she realizes a few things pretty quickly. One, this guy doesn't know Alex. Alex had literally met him that day in Paris. He is not a millionaire. He does not live in New York. He does not work in fashion. He runs a gas station on Long Island. And that is how my grandparents met.
And Alex, which is kind of extraordinary, doesn't even, I think you say, mention this. You know, he saves his sister's life in this. I mean, do you think he was, in his memoir, this is not something he even mentions. Is it, do you think, that he was kind of ashamed because he knew that he had condemned her to some sort of unhappiness, or was it, what do you think?
He always loved my grandmother's grandfather. Alex and my grandfather were really great friends, so I don't think he necessarily felt guilty about it. I think he knew she was unhappy, and this was not a story he could spin positively in his memoir. But I think the main thing is, Alex was a wonderful man. I knew him well. He died in 1999 when I was 21. But he was very self-obsessed in a lot of ways. And his memoir is about himself. And so what he wrote in his memoir is what he was doing during the war. What my grandmother was up to was kind of no concern to him. You know, okay, he got her out, fine, that's good. He tried to get his mother naturalized, didn't really work. But, you know, he managed to stash her somewhere. But what he was writing about was his adventures with Chagall, his adventures with Christian Dior, him in the resistance, him escaping from the train to the camps. Like, that's what he wrote about.
Yeah, I mean, Alex, in a way, he is the sort of, not quite the centre, but he's the most fascinating character in the book and the most complex one, I think.
It's true. And it was hard when I started writing it because I really initially wanted to just write about my grandmother, and then it quickly became clear that I have to write about the whole family. And I was a bit worried that Alex would overshadow everything, mainly because he was overshadowing things for me, because his life is so incredible. And there were times when I thought, should I just actually be writing about Alex? But I think kind of they all work together, because Alex's life was all about outward show and drama. I mean, Alex, you know, he's arrested by Brunner. He's put on the train. He's going to the camp to Drancy. He knows his brother Jacques has already been killed in Auschwitz at this point. He's thinking that he's going to be condemned to his brother's death. He happens to look up. He sees a hole in the ceiling.
I thought they only found out that Jacques had been killed later.
They were confirmed, but he knew that Jacques had gone, in Pithiviers, and he had an idea of what was happening because of his contacts in the resistance. He didn't know for sure, but he had a good idea of what was going on, and he knew Jacques was in the camps. And so Alex happened to look up, sees this hole in the ceiling of the train. Alex was very small, he's 5'2". He got his friend Jacques.
So obviously bugged him all his life.
All his life. He's constantly going on about how handsome all his tall brothers are. And obviously, I think it was a lot of overcompensation for him that he was so kind of, you know, sort of blustersome and pugnacious because he was 5'2". And he saw this hole in the ceiling. He got his friend Jacques Schwab-Ericourt to pick him up. His friend picks him up. Alex punches through this hole in the ceiling and got his friend to propel him out. So Alex Alex is thrown out of this train. That's
right. 90 kilometres an hour.
90 kilometres an hour. His ribs are broken. His face is all ripped up. Some communist railway workers find him. They hide him in a pile of manure because they know the Nazis are too vain about their uniforms to look through manure. They give him a little railway costume to keep him hiding. And then someone, and I didn't find out until quite later, helps Alex hide out in the Auvergne.
Yeah, now you didn't believe half the things in his book. And there's this kind of extraordinary bit where you're going, could he really have jumped off the train? Did he make that bit up?
Yeah, well, I mean, all this was one of the very few stories Alex would tell us, was that he escaped from the train. So we all knew he escaped from the train. But then we also thought, who escapes from the train? Like, how can you escape from the train? So I found the records of all the people who got off at Drancy. You can find them very easily in the National Archives in Paris. And Alex's name isn't there. Okay, well, that proves he didn't get off at Drancy. Fine, I also know who survived. I know he doesn't go to the camps and die. But did he get on? Well, it turns out you can find that out too. So I went down to Nice, and there are the records of everyone who got on, and there he is. He did get on. He didn't get off. And Serge Klarsfeld has written a little bit about people who escaped from the train. Serge Klarsfeld, the great Holocaust historian in France, writes a lot about Nice because he was there as a child. And it turns out there were 93 people who escaped from the train, and Alex is one of them.
I hope all of them met communist railway workers.
Yes, quite. I mean, you know, in some cases you think, well, okay, maybe some of them died and were thrown off the train. You know, the people get on and don't get off. But there were definitely people who escaped from the train. Funnily enough, my father's best friend, his father also escaped from a train, but he was caught and put back on. So, I mean, there are lots of different narratives. It's just incredible that Alex escaped.
But Alex's story, I mean, what's so fascinating about his wartime story, I think, you know, apart from the obvious derring do, is the way in which it involves a kind of negotiation. And, you know, as you say, up until he starts getting, I assume, drunkenly frisky in a nightclub, you know, he's actually doing okay. He's allowed to move his fashion house and keep it open in Cannes. Mm. You know, there's even hanging over him the suspicion of some sort of collaboration
Absolutely.
Going on there. And he had this sort of powerful patron who was apparently playing absolutely both sides against the middle.
It's true. And the thing that really fascinated me about Alex's story is that it shows so much of the shifting alliances in the Vichy government, which I knew nothing about. One of the things I feared when I started researching this was that I was going to find out that Alex was a collaborationist. And it turns out there were people in Vichy who were helping him. The reason is, it's not that Alex was a collaborationist. It's that a lot of people in Vichy, yes, they were anti-Semitic, but they were anti-Semitic in the way that they wanted to protect France's cultural identity. They didn't want these kind of outsider Jewishness invading it, but they also definitely didn't want outsider Germanness invading it. So if they had a Jew like Alex who had fought for France, had got a Bronze Star in the Narvik campaign, they would help him because he was fighting for France. So there was one guy, Xavier Vallat, who was in charge of the Aryanization of businesses in France, in other words, taking businesses away from the Jews, who allowed Alex to open his salon in the south of France, even though many other people protested, because Xavier Vallat was an anti-Semite, but he was mainly concerned about protecting the sanctity of France. He was not interested in these Germans. And actually that eventually worked against him. 3 months after he helped Alex, he was kicked out by the Germans. This guy called Louis Darquier-Pellepoix was put in, who was a full-throated Nazi supporter. And weirdly, this strange coincidence, Melvin Bragg has actually written a lot about Louis Darquier de Pellepoix because his daughter then became a psychoanalyst in this country and caused enormous damage among some of her patients, including Melvin Bragg's late wife. And he himself has talked about that. It's a side story. It's very hard not to get distracted by side stories when telling this kind
of
story.
Side stories, yeah.
And with Alex's main patron was this guy called General Perret, whose daughter was a client of Alex's when Alex ran his salon in Paris. General Perret was very, very high up in Vichy. But again, he was someone who was concerned about the sanctity of France. He was not interested in Nazi identity. So he was helping Alex, and it was actually him in the end who helped stash Alex away in this farmhouse in the Auvergne, which eventually I found and found the hidden room that Alex lived in.
And Perret had been, I mean, it wasn't just Alex he helped. I mean, he seems to have helped a lot of the resistance and the collaborators, even as he was in charge of cracking down on the resistance. It's kind of an extraordinary story.
Completely amazing. And I had no idea about it. I've eventually found the records for his trial that are in Poitiers. And there were all these Jews standing up saying, this man helped me, this man got me false ID, this man did this, this man did that. While at the same time, this man was in charge of rounding up specific resistance groups. He was also helping people connected to those resistance groups. In the end, he was sentenced in the opération légale when France was pretending there was only a few bad apples who'd been working with the Nazis. So he was condemned in the end for working with the Nazis, but eventually he was quietly excused.
Yeah, I mean, the question of, you know, how much France, you say, is sort of getting to grips a bit now with the extent of, you know, how much voluntary,
oh, yeah,
you know, work they did to put down the Jews in the war, and how much they, you know, the Nazis didn't even have to ask them half the time.
No, they, I mean, they went further than the Nazis asked. You know, the Nazis never asked them to send Jewish babies, children and sick people to the camps, and they did. And Vichy's excuse for that was by throwing more foreign Jews under the bus than that would save the French Jews. And to an a certain extent, they were kind of right. You know, a lot of French Jews did survive. The majority of French Jews did survive. But you cannot outpace fascists. And, you know, it's never going to be a good look. And a lot of people died, particularly a lot of children died who really didn't have to.
Yeah. You also, there's a kind of sort of a vibration of anger when you go and visit Auschwitz as well.
I mean, what's interesting really is the difference between Poland and France and their feelings about their collaborationism during the war. I mean, one example of how things are changing in France is when I went to Pithiviers, the French concentration camp where Jacques went. When I went in 2012, there was no memorial, really. There was no sign. It just looked like this dusty French road. Now there is a memorial. There's a whole museum. So that's changed in the past 8 years. You go to Poland now. Even just 5 years ago, Poland was very open about its collaborationism to a certain extent during the war. Obviously, Poland was invaded, but Poland had been a very, very anti-Semitic country. It's why my grandmother and her brothers had left in the first place. And there, you know, there are stories of Polish heroism, but these are exceptions. You know, to a large extent, Poles were pointing out Jews in the street and saying "Juden, Juden" to the Germans. You go to Auschwitz now, since the Law and Justice Party is in power, and the emphasis there is very much on Polish suffering. And it is true that 70,000 Poles did die at Auschwitz, but over 1 million Jews did, and there is a strong suggestion of, at the very least, parity of the suffering there. And if you take the official tour, they'll show you where the Poles were killed. They won't show you, for example, the gas chambers. They'll show you the, you know, for want of a better word, cabins where the Jews were living. So you have this strong impression that the Jews were being, you know, sent there and then lived there, when of course the vast majority were immediately sent to the gas chambers. And various members of the Polish government have said that Auschwitz needs to stop focusing on quote-unquote foreign narratives, by which they mean Jewish narratives. They want Auschwitz to be a place of noble Polish suffering. And when you go to Auschwitz now, there is actually a literal gift shop in the car park with little I Heart Poland mugs and I Heart Poland t-shirts, because that's just what you want to buy after visiting Auschwitz. And when I went in 2018, I was so amazed by this. I wrote a little column in The Guardian about the Auschwitz gift shop in the paper. And I got these angry tweets from Auschwitz. And I thought, God's sake, Auschwitz. From the Auschwitz, actual Auschwitz memorial, blue tick thing. I thought, haven't you done enough to my family? You now have to reprimand me on Twitter. Is this progress? Is this what happens over a century? You kill one member of my family and then you tell me off on Twitter. And they were saying, it's not our gift shop. It's run by the local municipality. And I just thought, that does not make it better that it's run by the local government, that the local government thinks that Auschwitz is a sign of great Polish strength and Polish memorialism. It's not. It's a tragic sight. It doesn't make anyone want to buy an I Heart Poland magnet.
No, why not? Now, you've been writing this book for...
This is so long. It's so embarrassing. I'm like the Robert Caro of my family. It's so embarrassing. So I mean, the research took 18 years.
There's quite a lot of research in it, isn't there?
There is.
All over the place.
I do go all over.
I wasn't telling you off.
No. I feel like I don't wear my research lightly. I sort of worry about that. But I've spent 18 years researching it. And I feel like I need to add this. 3 of those years were just waiting for the Picasso archives to open in Paris. So I feel I should take 3 years off of that. But it's still 18 years research. 18 months writing. So,
but in the course of that, I'm wondering how your sense of it, of the importance of the project, and of, you know, how you were approaching it, sort of changed, because in the course of that time, anti-Semitism has become, you know, kind of a thing. I mean, not that it ever went away.
It has become a thing.
You know, but the oldest hatred has become a thing again.
It's a hot topic.
It's become in vogue.
It's true.
I mean, did that start to change the way you were approaching the book? Did it feel more urgent, or did it feel like what you were learning here was something that you were feeding into your rows, say, with Auschwitz on Twitter?
I think there's the latter, definitely. It definitely made me probably more combative in columns in the paper. I mean, most of the writing of this was done during the whole anti-Semitism row in Labour, and I probably did feel it maybe a bit more strongly than I would have if I hadn't been so immersed in this book. I mean, I've written about anti-Semitism before. I mean, I've been writing this book for so long, but, you know, I'd written about attacks in Paris and stuff like that before. But especially during the writing of this book, it made me so angry seeing some stuff in Labour and seeing people on the left kind of defending it, excusing it. People like Ken Loach saying, you know, Holocaust history, everything's up for debate. All that kind of stuff made me very upset. And it's funny, the book coming out now with the Tory party saying, you know, we're cracking down on unskilled immigrants entering the country. And, you know, I think, you know, like my great uncles, my grandmother, they were unskilled immigrants coming into Poland. They didn't have any money. So you sort of see repetitions of history that you wouldn't have necessarily. And also, of course, the Trump election. You know, I was working on this during his early years, and the Muslim ban in America hit me. And these are repetitions of things in America as well. The Johnson Reed Act.
You talk actually about how there was a particular book, which I can't cut a name, but you'll remember it, which in the 20s in America was the sort of urtext for, you know, anti-immigrant, anti-Semitic feeling.
Absolutely.
And the author goes and meets Hitler.
Goes and meets Hitler and was also praised strongly by Teddy Roosevelt. And he then inspired the Johnson Reed Immigration
Act. What was the book called again?
Madison Grant. Yeah. Madison Grant, yeah. So Madison Grant was this eugenicist who had this idea that certain races were superior to others. And the main ones, obviously, you know, unsurprisingly, inevitably, with these kind of people, is Northern European. And Southern European were kind of dirty and diseased. And Eastern European, you definitely didn't want those in Asian, God forbid. So he really inspired these two immigration acts that completely cut down the Jewish immigrants who were coming into New York. And the numbers, the fall in numbers is really astonishing. It was, you know, it was going from like 100,000 one year to 20,000 the next. And it was because of these acts that Anne Frank and her family couldn't leave Amsterdam and weren't able to escape.
So it's the other end of the...
Absolutely, and it also shows that America...
It's all part of the process.
You know, America is hardly perfect. As much as America likes to style itself sometimes as this great savior of immigrants, I mean, it was pretty bad too. And the anti-Semitism in America, when my grandfather was growing up in the Lower East Side, is very, very similar to the anti-Semitism in Paris that my uncles were experiencing then in the 30s. And my father was born in America, and even when he went to college in the 50s, there was still a very tight quota on the number of Jews admitted every year. I mean, he got into that 10%. That were allowed in that year. It's extraordinary. Yeah.
But your father has some of Alex in him, judging by his story from his school days. I mean, it's interesting.
I mean, it's equal parts, I think, Alex and his father. My father is, and I say this with full objectivity, he is a very, very brilliant man. He is like bilingual in seven languages.
Heptalingual.
Exactly. He's 80 years old. He reads more than I do. He remembers everything. I mean, it's quite intimidating having my dad in some ways. I mean, my dad could have written this book much better than me. But when he was at school, he was at this little... what we call public school, what you call state school in Long Island. And he had taught himself to read at the age of 4, and you know the other kids in his class were still learning at 8, and he would get really bored, and he would read ahead while everybody else was doing the on the mat. And he would read ahead. And the teacher kept telling him out, saying, "Ronald, stop reading ahead." And the teacher clipped him on the head, and my father stood up at the age of 8 and punched her in the stomach. And the teacher insisted that my father was, use the term that they used in the 40s in Long Island, mentally retarded. And so the school then tested his IQ, and it went off the charts. It was the highest IQ they'd ever had in the school. And so on the back of that, my grandmother moved them out of this tiny little pokey town into a better town with a better school. And then my father went on to Lehigh. And ironically, you know, I didn't even put this in the book. It's another like avenue I could have gone down. But in my father's class with him was Donald Trump's older brother. And Donald used to come up and visit all the time and hang out. I mean, Donald was like 16, I guess. I think Donald Trump's probably like 5 years younger than my dad. And he was like 16 and my dad was like 19. And he just remembers this really bratty, red-haired kid who used to come up and try to pinch all the female teachers' butts. Plus ça change.
Exactly, it began. And what's, you know, as you were writing this, were you conscious of the sort of reaction of the members of your family who survive, you know, of digging up things that maybe they didn't want known about?
Yes, is the short answer. I was very aware. And in a way, it made Jack the easiest to write about because he had no descendants. I think my father was worried I was going to find out that Alex was a collaborator. Nobody was ever saying, don't do this. I think, if anything, they were saying, why is it taking you so bloody long? Can you just write this damn book already? But there were things that people were concerned about. And obviously, in a family, everybody wants to tell their version of the story. And I gave my father, obviously, you know, approval rights when I finished the manuscript. And there were only one or two tiny things that he thought I hadn't got quite right. And it wasn't anything major. It was more about what his mother was like when they were in Long Island. But I was aware of, not really of people alive, I was aware of the people dead. I mean, you know, I was looking through photos that they'd never expected me to see, let alone publish to the world. And I mean, a real obvious example of that is I found these photos that Henri took of him and Sonia when they were courting. And Sonia's like taking off an item of clothing.
Sonia was Henri's wife. Yes.
So this is when they were dating. And the last photo ends with her like wearing this very skimpy top and lying on a bed with her legs spread. It's very, very sexy. And I thought, is this something that they would want me to look at, let alone put in a book? And I knew my great aunt Sonia, and she was, you know, she was a firecracker. And I think I just kind of thought, you know what? She probably would.
Yeah, there's kind of thing that was never quite explained. She and Alex absolutely loathed each other. Why was that? Did you
yes.
get to the bottom of that?
Well, first of all, Alex saw Henry, who is his older brother, as basically his father. He was a paternal figure. And Alex was like the kind of son who thought no stepmother was good enough. No woman was ever good enough for Henri. And particularly Sonia, who came from what is now the Ukraine, he just saw her as this kind of what he would call a dirty Polak is how he referred to her, even though it was the Ukraine. You know, she was short.
He was Polish.
And he was Polish. I mean, there was a lot of self-loathing there. And she looked a lot like him. She was short. She was round. She was really bolshy. She was really smart. I mean, in a lot of ways, she was exactly like Alex. And in some ways, they were too similar. For Sonia's part, she looked at Alex and thought he was this uneducated, coarse snob. And, you know, there are probably arguments for that. You know, he had never really gone to school. Sonia had had an upper-class upbringing, really, when she was a child. She'd had this aristocratic nanny. She'd gone through school. She was very, very smart and educated and cultured. She just thought Alex was just this idiot. Alex just looked at her and just thought, you are not good enough for my brother. He should be with a French model. And they never, ever made up. They lived, you know, 2 miles away from each other their whole life. They absolutely hated each other. And when Henry died, Sonia was obviously at the funeral, it's her husband, and Alex turns up and just starts screaming at her and said, it's your fault he died. And the ironies of that are so layered. First of all, it was Sonia who saved Henry's life multiple times during the war. It was her who sorted out his false identity. It was really her who kept them hidden. It was her who found them food on the black market. And the weird thing is, I feel like Alex was actually confusing Sonia with Jacques' wife. Jacques' wife, Mila, was dumb, was sort of very passive and useless. And she is the one who told Jacques to register as a Jew. And when Jacques was given permission to leave the camp to visit their newborn child, she's the one who told him he had to go back because he promised. So she...
That is the kind of killer moment,
isn't
it? Oh,
it's incredible. I mean, she said, il a donné sa parole. He gave his word. And so Jacques goes back to the camp.
We should set the scene. The brothers are in the room.
In the hospital.
Like, you're out!
You're out. Run away. Run away. We will hide you. And no one was ever given permission to leave Pithiviers. It's incredible that Jacques was. I went to the Pithiviers archives, this amazing museum in France called Cercil, which has their day-to-day records and everything, which is how I was able to recreate Jacques' life. And the woman there was just, this is incredible. I've never seen anyone get leave, you know, like this. And I think the guards let Jacques leave because they trusted him. He was so passive and compliant that they knew he would come back. Jacques leaves. He goes to Paris. He's in the hospital. The brothers are saying, this is the chance of your lifetime. We will help you. Sonia said, I can find an apartment for you. I can find food for you. We will hide you and your daughter and your wife. And Mila, his wife, is lying there on the bed. And she said, il a donné sa parole. He has to go back. And Jacques does. And he goes back to the camp. He's then 3 months later put on the train to Auschwitz, along with Irène Nemirovsky, who wrote Sweet Française. And he's killed. And so Mila killed Jacques. Sonia never killed Henry. But in Alex's mind, the two women were basically conflated.
And there's this terrible thing. Sarah says, I think, because Auschwitz was so close to Galicia, whenever she's asked about him.
Yeah, she goes, they sent him home. And I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, Jacques never wanted to leave. He just wanted to have this quiet life. He's sort of forced to France. He lives in France, tries to make his life there, has a wife and child. And in the end, he's sent back to his home. And he dies just 18 kilometers from where his father is buried. It's a really kind of amazing story.
That's sent him home. Maybe we should end there. Adelaide Freeman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. And if you did, we very much hope that you'll subscribe on your podcast provider of choice and or rate and review us. Well, especially if you liked it. If you hated it, don't feel you have to review it. And equally, if there's something that you wanted to ask us about, something you think we could do better or something you enjoyed, please do send us your feedback to podcast@spectator.co.uk. Thanks again for listening. And please join us for our next episode.